Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hello and welcome to another episode of GoTo Unscripted. My name is James Lewis. I'm here at GoTo Amsterdam with Suzanne Kaiser. And we've been, we're probably going to talk today a little bit about a joint interest, which is the idea of flow. So maybe Suzanne, you can introduce yourself and what you've been talking about here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's really lovely. I am Suzanne Kaiser. I am an independent tech consultant, and I am trying to help organizations of different sizes to unlock their blockers to flow and try to support them to design, build, implementing adaptive socio-technical systems that are optimized for a fast flow of value, a fast flow of change, and constant feedback, and bringing different tool sets. So I remember from your talk, for example, that one of our expertise that we have a suitcase of tools, bringing them. And so I also come with my tiny suitcase of tools as well, with my tool set to bring that in and turn to depending on the context of the client, what makes most sense to apply there and to analyze the current situation and where their blockers to flow are and what could be then the vision for the future target architecture from different perspectives.
Is that sort of North Star, I guess, to aim towards?
Yeah, it is. It's more like a North Star in terms of it's also about something that you can approach in increments and iteratively. So it's not like that we sit there in our ivory tower deciding where to go, or not me, because I usually work with the teams together, because otherwise it's not very helpful, because I'm not implementing them together with them. It's just like designing the future architecture.
It's not sitting in a room and sort of drawing the pictures. It's being with people who are actually doing the work then,
basically. Exactly. That is my main way of working together with the teams, and also try to identify, analyze their blockers to flow. What are the pain points, starting from where the teams are right now, and what is blocking them delivering value to the customers, and also what are the pain points, what are the challenges, and also what works well. So what would we like to keep as well? Bringing in different perspectives.
So you mentioned bringing a toolbox or toolkit. And obviously I've seen your talk this week and also previously, and it's brilliant. You have to go and watch it when it's published. There's a lot of really interesting tools in that toolkit, right? So counting, there's Wardley mapping, there's team topologies, there's domain-driven design. Where did you get the idea to bring all these things together originally?
Yeah, that evolved organically over the time. So first of all, when I was used to be a startup CTO, I was like, there was a journey from monolith to microservices. So that's where domain-driven design came in back then.
Right.
So I remember when I gave my first talk, and you, James, were sitting in the front row. So I really got inspired by your articles about microservices, and also Sam Newman was sitting there. That's the moment where I was like diving more into domain-driven design to find potential boundaries to split domain logic specific boundaries to split your system apart. And then also I was like more into the field of microservices and domain-driven design, and then serverless came along, and I was also interested in, okay, how does this technology work? I was attending serverless technology conferences, and whenever at every serverless conference, Simon Wardley was there giving a talk. So that was by coincidence. And then I was listening to his keynote, and was really entertaining, and was thinking, oh, that sounds amazing, but how can I apply it to my own context? Mm. So, and then I tried to, the first thing was that I tried to combine a Wordle map based domain-driven design to have added, so I modified a little bit of Wordle map back then. So I added a separate layer, like from bringing domain-driven design together with Wordle maps, because the user, usually when you create this Wordle map of the value chain on the y-axis with user and user needs, that it describes beautifully the problem domain from domain-driven design. And then when you go and then to the components that fulfill the user needs and directly or indirectly, when you have this chain of components in your value chain, that then comes in where the solution space comes in, where you can then apply the bounded context and so on. And on the problem space, you can then combine, bring in subdomain times of core domain, what's provide competitive advantage, why is your supporting subdomain and your generic subdomains on the problem space. And then on the evolution space, it's like, okay, where to build versus buy, where my or outsource decision and combining them. So that was the first combination, like combining Wordle mapping with domain-driven design. And the next one was when the book came out, Team Topologies, end of 2019, I was like, oh, that is the missing piece. Because, because of Conway's law, we have to deal with also with socio-technical system, with also the team organization. And that was then the missing piece, where I then was bringing in also the team organization as well.
I have to say that, so I've read I've read Team Topologies. I've read, obviously, a lot of stuff around domain-driven design over the years. I've been practicing it for many years. And then, obviously, Wordle mapping has become quite a thing in the industry. And I know we're certainly in ThoughtWorks, we've sort of, we use it a lot as part of our engagements now, our more strategic engagements, certainly. But I think the first time when I saw your talk, I think it was the first time I actually it was able to line up some of these concepts in my head.
Really?
So I should thank you for that. Yeah, absolutely. So for example, you talk about value stream aligned teams in Team Topologies, and there's a tendency to, well, actually, is that because I think about value streams and but then actually you explore those ideas, don't you?
Yeah, and you can also complement it because you talked in your talk about value stream mapping, right? So in a Wordle map, we talk about value chain. So, and like what is necessary to fulfill user needs, what components connect in order to generate value for the customers. But you can also beautifully complement it with value stream mapping as well, where you go more into the process view for like maybe every component in the value chain can have its own value stream. And you have to bring in both perspectives in order to identify constraints. So where do we have a lot of like wait times, like you talked about in your talk about waiting times, like different types of waiting, like coordination, scheduling,
synchronization.
Queuing.
Exactly.
So, and that makes totally sense. So, and it's also to have to bring this to have a more dense picture. What can then block our flow of change and value?
I think. I mean, for me, I mean, maybe looping back a bit to the ivory tower thing. I think that's where a lot of people go. A lot of organizations go wrong when applying some of these ideas.
Yeah.
But then also with things like domain-driven design, it can be quite hard to know where to start.
Yeah.
Like to, you know, to tend to try and get, you get into this, I certainly have fallen into this sort of analysis paralysis. Is this correct? Is this precise? You know, have I got the right domain boundaries? How do you sort of deal with that kind of thing in your workshops?
Definitely, that is one of the biggest challenges to see, I guess. On the one side, it's crucial to find the right boundaries. And on the other side, like how to validate it. Like how is it really like? And so it's kind of like iterative process and it goes along the, so that we also gain feedback. For example, where do we, so for example, when we try to find the right boundaries to the so-called bounded context, where forming a boundary around domain models and I do this also together with the, with for example my clients' teams together because I am absolutely the domain noob in the room, so I have no clue about their domain. So I have to try to drive this conversation about a lot of the question, and I guess I try to like.
Does that help though? Right, often at being. Being the newbie, you get to ask the stupid questions.
Well, that's so deliberating because I can ask so many stupid questions. Maybe other people had the same question but didn't dare to ask them because they're already working there for a couple of years and they're supposed to know it and think that they're supposed to know it. In fact, it's still, so asking, it's really, really, really relieving to be the noob in the room. But what we try to do then, to picture then how, like when we have these boundaries, how we try to make a kind of like scenario plan, how a change would flow through the system. But this means that these are changes we know, like that we are the known knowns that we're dealing with. So what then we try to like, okay, when we make coming from the user needs, like when we have a change, maybe a customer is requesting a change, how would this change flow through the system? Like what bounded context might be affected, and what is the, and also what is the integration, the relationship between the bounded context with context map patterns, and what how the teams, how what teams are owning these bounded contexts, what do they have to interact and coordinate in order to make this change effective? So there's something. Do you have can you apply some heuristics like to derive this bounded context, but you're not sure at the end. So and it's always constantly validating, I would say. How do you do this? How do you usually
I think it's the same. I don't have the methodology. I haven't previously used the methodology that you're talking about. I mean, we tend to talk about tracer bullets. Maybe the metaphor isn't great, but the idea of asking questions of the domain and working out again which parts of the domain would be affected. I mean, it's the classic thing around tiered architectures. You know, in the old school, when you had like a web tier, and then you had data services, and you had a database, and you'd ask the question, which part of it changes when you have to make add a new feature, or you need to add a new field to a form or something, and the answer is all of it. Like, you know, to change everything and deploy everything, and suddenly it becomes a bit more obvious when you're using these sorts of techniques.
Absolutely.
Have you seen Barry O'Reilly's work on residuality?
No, unfortunately not yet. So I would love to. I plan to look at his talks. I guess he also gave talks at DDD Europe. And I would love to watch those.
Because he's got this really interesting idea of stresses. Yeah. He's talking specifically about software architecture, which I guess we are as well. But he talks about how the architecture the system that you have at the moment is the result of everything that's happened in the past. I guess is obvious. So with that sort of thinking and the stresses that were applied in the past, the stresses the system was put under and the code bases were put under. So, you know, can you use the same idea in the future? So when you talk about these, I call them tracer bullets, you talked about, what was it, the future changes?
Flow of changes.
Thinking about the different types of stressor, the unknown unknowns.
Yeah.
And coming up with a set of these unknown unknowns and then applying it to Wordy maps.
That is a great technique. So that seems to be very interesting to see, specifically when you like stresses and forms, like what could happen and you're not aware of, and to see like how your system would react to that. That's how I understood it, right? To apply some stress patterns or something like that, and to see where your system would respond to, or where might maybe apply some changes, and does this part of the system need some change in that part, and at the same time maybe that's an indication they belong together, and maybe we have to revalidate or reiterate on our bounded context to bring them together, for example.
Stay with us, we'll be right back.
Should I be excited or afraid of AI? The answer is yes, it's both.
Things are going to look so different in the next couple years. You will not be ready for the disruptions that are going to come.
I'm Jeff Nielsen, host of Digital Disruption, the go-to podcast for technology leaders.
Our generation's conflict, I think, is going to be emotional, not economic.
The companies that are going to win are the ones that have a couple of characteristics.
Stay ahead of the curve with Digital Disruption, available now on your favorite podcast platform.
One thing I'm kind of fascinated by as well, because I spend a lot of time doing this sort of work with teams as well. One of the things I often find and get feedback afterwards on is when you get disparate people together and you get a lot of people from different parts of the organization together, all talking together for the first time. Mm-hmm. And that seems like a super energizing thing. And almost, you almost get, I've seen teams almost get as much out of just being able to talk to their colleagues that they didn't know new stuff.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So, so that's really like the conversation that sparked from bringing different domains together, or different roles or departments together. And then they come up with or revealing some situations like, oh, we have never known that you do this manually. So, we could have supported you in your daily work by, and it's just like, we can just like add it to our code and it could generate something, and maybe it's just integrating another system that they're manually using. They are copying, for example, one part of the software into another part of the software manually. And then when we bring them together, it's like, damn it, we haven't known it. So, because we have never talked to each other before, like that this was a problem and they just accepted it. So it was like, yeah, okay, we have to do it manually. Okay, we copy it. No, it's like really revealing sometimes.
And, yeah, and also for me, also, I mean, that sort of almost shadow IT stuff that you find as well, right? Where it's like, oh no, we do that in Excel. Why are you doing that in Excel?
Yeah,
this
exactly.
thing does it. No, we've always done it in Excel. And then the other thing I think with domain-driven design in particular, we talk a lot about ubiquitous language in domain-driven design and the importance of having the ubiquitous language. Another thing I've noticed is that often different parts of the organization, different domains, it becomes really clear that they've got these different languages, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, I talked to an attendee at this at GoTo today about like, for example, use customer, like customer. Whenever you talk to different departments, it has different meanings. But across the context, across departments, it has it has different meanings across the departments. But within that department, it's a clear meaning. So they look at you confused, like, no, for us, a customer is this and this. But if you talk to another department, a customer has totally different meanings. For example, invoicing is a different meaning than, I mean, if you are elite or like, in the e-commerce system. So it has a different meaning, different attributes, different business logic behind it. And so I guess that's also the source of so much confusion, right? And we can't have like one God object of customer. Because then this is like, this goes then into the system and it introduces then tight change coupling or tight coupling. If you have like, for example, at another client, I had an account object with 400 different fields.
Oh, wow. That was a big constructor.
it was kind of like really large. And who introduced that field? So when we changed that one, what side effect does it have then? So I don't know if you change the name or even worse than the type of it, then... You just change it and maybe it's just something as others is exploding because you had one huge, massive God object. And so that's the reason, like ubiquitous language in terms of like, that is has a different meaning there and that it might be a totally different domain model there. And yeah, so it's really important.
I remember one account we just started, we found this God object in the code base and it was a transaction handler. I think it was called like transaction handler because of course, maybe even transaction handler, factory, impl or something, you know. And it just had like a do transaction method on it. And that took 48 parameters, which was nice, in an array. So it weren't even typed. You just and you had to like infer. Like, I've no idea how they ever changed it ever, you know. It's
and this cognitive load, right? This mental effort to understand this piece of code and like specifically when onboarding new people and when you make a change there
it's pretty awful. I mean, you mentioned microservices. It's interesting because we both go back a long way in that. I mean, it's 10 years this year since Martin and I published that. And we started talking very shortly afterwards. And I know, you know, talk about God objects and things. One of the things I had was at the start was no shared domain code. Because if you start sharing domain code in libraries.
Exactly. Yeah. So that is like, I guess Sam Newman also mentioned this and then maybe it also stems from you, like the don't repeat yourself principle does not apply to microservices because if you try to share everything, specifically when it's like, domain code or domain logic, which changes frequently, that is then, you introduce coupling and a distributed model is again, and it's even worse than your monolith. So I don't, I don't want to call a monolith bad, so sorry. You hear it here.
Monoliths are fine. Modular monoliths are fine.
Yeah, exactly.
Simon Brown is around. He'll storm through the door and shout at us if we don't make that clear.
Exactly. Absolutely.
So back to, I guess, the 4D mapping, back to architecture for flow, team topologies and things. What sort of changes have you seen organizations go through when you've been applying these sort of techniques?
So I guess more like a clear ownership boundaries, and also like that they have then freeing energy to focus on their core domains or the core activities of the teams themselves. So they are not, so that they have get a clearer picture or reduce team cognitive load and have also energy and time to think new ideas through. So that is something relieving for the teams that I've seen so far. Also like that they have this like clear purpose. So, and also even though if they are not have split it yet, but for example, just visualizing the status quo. For example, I had one client, we do so many things, but we can't really express it. And we have then identified that these were mostly platform teams, but they were also enablers. So they're also facilitating, and which takes a long time, right, to upskill other teams. Mm. It is a different interaction mode when you are coaching others than providing excessive services. So, and they had different interaction mode, and to make this clear, explicit, that yes, of course, you're spending, it's not like boiled down into user stories, because that is some activities that you do on the side, right? And to make it explicit, and then they can they brought this one seat, that's the reason why we stuck sometimes. And either we have a dedicated team at some point, or we change something. So I guess more increased clarity of purpose, then the increased clarity of ownership, and also when to collaborate together when exploring, and also when to provide excessive services, or like how to interact with other teams. So that was very like more a kind of like freeing some energy and focus. And that's what I could say so far.
Well, so everything, more clarity is always going to be good, right? I think that's, that's fantastic. And do you see the teams then? Because one of the things I'm quite passionate about is, I've said it before, but, you know, we turn up with these toolboxes, as you sort of alluded to, and often, as consultants or as independents, we get hired because of the toolboxes. But I feel it's like incumbent on us to leave those tools behind in a way, right? So and actually ensure that the organizations we're working with actually can use those in an ongoing way. Have you got experience? Do you teach other people? Do you coach the teams to do this themselves as well?
Yeah, so it's sometimes a combination of training and then working together with this tool together. I guess it's to bring in the fundamentals. So also the why we are using it, the purpose of those tools. And sometimes I'm not sure. Sometimes it's that I don't say we have to always use those. Maybe we can complement with those others. So it's not like
things like event storming and lots of other.
So it's not a rigid framework.
No.
So sometimes I tell them like the purpose behind it and the fundamentals and the concepts, and then we also involve them in their workshops. So sometimes it's the workshop starts with the fundamentals, sometimes not. It depends on also the context itself.
Yeah.
And then afterwards they then can, so I hope that they, so my role is then to, that I enable them to use those tools so that they can explore in their own domains, because we start only have a few domains, and then that they can go on their own and apply those.
I remember being at a client where we use that sort of technique where you sort of use a bit of the theory and then you sort of use a toy. Liz Keogh, who, she's a former colleague and she's awesome, was behind J-Behave originally, one of the people that really took behavior-driven development forward. But she talks about this idea of breakable toys and how you can, you can use thought experiments, or you can use simplified versions in order to teach people how to do stuff. And we did that with value stream mapping. So you kind of explain what a value stream map is and people go, okay, fine. And then you sort of explain the different types of weighting and wait times and these sorts of things. And then you say, okay, well, imagine you're at home and you've just closed the door and you're on your way to work. Create the value stream of getting to work as a group or whatever. Mm-hmm. And using those sort of really simple examples, it really lands with a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And I've had, good experience, especially when there's lots of people to train. Mm-hmm. Doing those sort of simple things, and then that seems to get quite good results. So it's cool.
Yeah, and also bridging then the gap from the general or generic example to apply it to their own context. I guess then it clicks like, okay, now I've understood the concepts, but now I can apply it to my own context, and it's then more tangible when we then dive into their domain. And
so what are you hoping for the future of this idea of architecture for flow?
Sorry,
say what are you thinking about the future of this? I know you've got a book on the way.
Yes. Sorry, it took so long. Yeah, it's
I'm just annoyed because I can't wait to read it.
So. I'm sorry. You get an extra version. Yeah. So we will drink some beverages later on. I hope that it's usable for other organizations as well. And I also would love to see how you apply it in your context. And maybe you say, also learning from feedback of the readers in terms of like if this is applicable to their context and they have applied it, or maybe what obstacle they had to apply it, and also like what was valuable to have both sides, and to I see it as a continuously improving method to a tool set that helps you to, as I said, to design and build and evolve adaptive socio-technical systems, and also it also adapts. That's what I see. It's also an adaptive system as well. So that's what I see for the future.
I think what's brilliant about this work you've been doing is you've taken three things that are sort of almost become canonical ways of looking at certain parts of our world in the sort of work we do in big organizations, building big software systems. And you've managed to combine these three canonical things to create something that's actually bigger than all of them, I think. So for me, thank you, because there's a lot of techniques that I'm gonna borrow, steal in the future for my work. And I suggest you all take a look at Suzanne's talks and buy a book when it's out. So. I think on that note, I'll say thank you very much, Suzanne, for coming into Go To Unscripted. And I've been James Lewis, and goodbye for now. Bye-bye.
Thank you, and goodbye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.